Hey, I'm Noam Weissman, and you're listening to Unpacking Israeli History, the podcast that takes a deep dive into some of the most intense, historically fascinating, and often misunderstood events and stories linked to Israeli history. This episode of Unpacking Israeli History is generously sponsored by Barbara and Rick Silverman, the Marcus Family Foundation, and Michael Steinberg. Before we start, like I remind you at each episode, I love hearing from you. So shoot me a note at noam@jewishunpack.com. Tell me if you have a brilliant idea or your thoughts on an episode or a question you have. Your insights are what keeps the show going. It makes it so interesting. So please, please keep connecting with me. Reach out to me at noam@jewishunpack.com. Okay, yalla, let's do this.
We, the people of Israel, are prepared and anxious to meet the representatives of our neighbors without any preconditions.
There are people in Israel and elsewhere say it's impossible to make peace between the Arabs and Israel or the Jewish people. I think they are wrong.
Remember 2012? According to Wikipedia, this was the year that the terms hot take and escape room were coined. Pretty interesting. People were weirdly into the Mayan calendar. Also interesting. And most importantly, then President of Israel, Shimon Peres, released his first and only single.
Be my friend. Share peace. Speak up and change the world. Be my friend for peace.
Yeah, that was a banger. Kind of wish he put out a whole EP, to be honest. But the 88-year-old president wasn't just spitting hot fire for the sake of it. His song had a message. Though it might seem naive to us now, Peres truly believed that social media would bring people together. So he launched a campaign inviting anyone and everyone to be his Facebook friend for peace. It's amazing. Of course, this was before the youth had migrated off Facebook to cooler platforms, I guess. Peres hosted Facebook chats for kids around the world and addressed young people in Arab and Muslim countries. He even opened a Snapchat account shortly before his death at the age of 93, hoping to connect with young people on their level. I can only hope to be that cool. But as adorable as all of this is, and it is freaking adorable, I don't think anyone would call this campaign a smashing success. Not sure it went into his autobiography as the best things I ever did. Social media can be a toxic cesspit of misinformation and anti-Semitic bile. And that is quite the mouthful for a guy who helps lead a media company. You've seen our unpacked videos on YouTube and all the places, right? And after 10/7, peace seems further away than ever. But why? Why? And I don't mean why are things bad right now in 2024? Things are bad right now because several months ago, Hamas launched the most horrific attack in Israel's history, murdering 1,200 people and kidnapping 253 all in one horrible day. And Israel responded with an intensity the world has seen play out on social media. But as hard as it feels to remember, there was a time before October the 7th. Yes, it was punctuated by flare-ups of violence.
Israelis experiencing another night of terror as Hamas continues to launch rockets on Israel's major cities. The IDF retaliating, dealing severe blows to major Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip.
By horrific kidnappings.
It's a very sad anniversary, and it's one that seems to touch every Israeli home. There's no one who doesn't know the faces of the parents of Gilad Shalit as well as the photo of Gilad Shalit himself. Many people here say to me, it's as if their own son had been snatched.
By astonishingly cruel acts of terror.
June 1st, 2001, Saturday night in Tel Aviv, hundreds of young people were crowding in front of the Dolphin nightclub right on the beach. Among them, a Hamas terrorist stood unsuspecting. He mingled with the rest of the young adults there, none of them realizing what was about to happen.
But there were also moments of hope.
Today, the leadership of Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization will sign a declaration of principles on interim Palestinian self-government. It charts a course toward reconciliation between two peoples who have both known the bitterness of exile.
Moments where it seemed as though peace was on its way. Because if anyone could solve a seemingly intractable problem, I think it's the Jewish people. The Jewish people's entire history is one long demonstration of beating the odds. Israel made it through the wars of 48, 56, 67, 73, signed a peace deal with Egypt in 79, with Jordan in 94, eventually normalized relations with the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and Sudan. Sudan, literally the country where in 1967, the Arab League swore never to recognize or negotiate with Israel. Remember the Khartoum resolution? Yep, in Sudan. Even Saudi Arabia is talking about normalization. Saudi Arabia, a country where it's illegal to publicly practice any religion other than Islam. So yeah, the Jewish people and Israel have beaten a lot of odds. But lasting and sustainable peace with the Palestinians, its closest neighbor? That's Israel's white whale. Maddeningly elusive. Maybe it's the abundance of options. Faced with so many choices, no one can quite decide what's right. One Israel river to sea or one Palestine river to sea? One democratic binational state or one joint Israeli-Palestinian government functioning alongside the two existing governments? Or else the two-state solution, which is still the most popular model in Washington, if nowhere else. Between all these options, something has to work. Something. After all, countries with much uglier histories have managed to overcome their histories. The United States dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan. Today, they're close allies. Rwandan Hutus massacred 800,000 of their Tutsi neighbors in 100 days. 30 years later, Rwanda is considered a model for reconciliation. The border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic was once studded with checkpoints. Today, those checkpoints have been dismantled, and traffic flows freely in either direction. Now, I know none of these are perfect analogs, but why not Israelis and Palestinians? Why are they still mired in this bitter mess? Well, I've got some thoughts, or rather, I have some questions, for them to be precise. And I'm not the only one asking them. These are questions that have tanked every peace agreement, confounding Israeli and Palestinian leaders alike. And I'm not talking about major questions like, how can we erase decades of hatred and mistrust and indoctrination? Or even, how can each side be sure that the other is sincere? No, I'm talking about questions of policy. And don't fall asleep just because I said the word policy. I promise this won't be C-SPAN. A shout out to C-SPAN. Kind of cool in a countercultural sort of way. How does one handle the major stumbling blocks that have divided Israelis and Palestinians for so long? Questions like, what do we do with Jerusalem? And who gets the right of return? So the next two episodes will be divided into four chapters, each focusing on a different major issue. The four major issues. I hope these chapters will illustrate why these issues are so divisive, why there's no one solution that will please everyone. And at the end, I'm going to present my comprehensive four-point plan to address them all and bring peace to the Middle East. Okay, that last part is a lie. I don't have the answers. I'm not sure anyone does. I know a lot of people think they do, but I do have lots of questions. And against all odds, a lot of hope. So let's begin. Before I do that, though, I want to ask for your permission to join me in this conversation. I want to ask for a little more humility, perhaps, a little bit more empathy than I normally ask for when listening, because these topics are complicated, really complicated. They're personal to many people listening, and they're important. I was even unsure if we should do this episode, but my team convinced me otherwise, and I think they were right. Let's explore the issues together. Chapter 1, Jerusalem, aka Al-Quds. Jerusalem is arguably the most famous city on Earth. And if not the most famous, definitely top five, and don't ask me to list the others, but it's definitely top five. In the words of historian Simon Sebag Montefiore, whose book Jerusalem, an Autobiography, is an absolute masterpiece. Quote, Jerusalem is the house of the one God, the capital of two peoples, the temple of three religions, and she is the only city to exist twice, in heaven and on earth. The city even has a syndrome named after it, albeit a controversial one. Jerusalem Syndrome. It's a religious psychosis, a sort of madness that can overtake you once you visit the Holy City. I'm ready for someone to tell me they have unpacking Israeli history syndrome. That's how we'll know we made it. That's how we'll know we're going places. Well, whether or not you believe that Jerusalem Syndrome is real, there's no doubt that the city has captured the world's imagination. Even today, Jews, Christians, Muslims are spellbound by their own specific vision and version of Jerusalem. And it's a vision that they'll kill and die for. As Montefiore writes, quote, "Everyone has the right to impose their Jerusalem on Jerusalem, and with sword and fire they often have." As I record this, Israel is almost 150 days into a war they're calling Swords of Iron. The IDF is raining fire on Gaza, all because Hamas brutally invaded Israel in an operation they called Al-Aqsa Flood, after the iconic mosque in Jerusalem. Swords and fire, indeed. But why? Why does this small, hilly city, which gets really cold at night, even in the summers, inspire the sort of devotion that verges on madness? For Jews, it starts in the Hebrew Bible. God commands the Jewish people to journey to Jerusalem three times a year during the three pilgrimage festivals. It's the seat of the Jewish nation, the capital city of the original Jewish kingdom, the home of the two destroyed holy temples, the site where many Jews believe the third temple will someday be built. In Jewish tradition, Jerusalem is the center of the universe. This is where God first breathed life into Adam, where Abraham nearly sacrificed his son. This is the heart of the Jewish people. And so for thousands of years, Jews have built synagogues to face Jerusalem. It's in the prayers and the poetry and the artwork. Countless generations of Jews have journeyed to touch the stones of the Western Wall, the Kotel, the closest the Jewish people could get to their ancient holy temple. For centuries, the Jewish people have ended their Passover Seders with the words, "Next year in Jerusalem, L'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim." After I eat bread, I actually make a blessing after the meal. And in that blessing, I talk about Jerusalem. This blessing is thousands of years old. I sometimes wonder if people realize the inseparable connection. So yeah, this city is pretty important to Jews, including arguably the most famous Jew of all time. Who's that? Jesus. And that means that Jerusalem holds great importance to Christians. It was where Christians believe Jesus walked, where he ministered, where he died, where they believe he was reborn. European kings sent thousands of crusaders to Jerusalem to wrest control of the Holy Land from Muslims, then kill a few thousand Jews along the way, but I digress. Because Jerusalem is sacred to Muslims too. They believe that Muhammad, the founder of Islam, journeyed from Mecca to Jerusalem in a single night. In a miraculous way, he landed on the Temple Mount, where the Jewish Holy Temple once stood, and led Abraham, Moses, and Jesus in prayer. From there, he ascended to heaven to speak to God. In the Quran, Muhammad's journey takes him from Mecca to the furthest mosque, or in Arabic, Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. That's why Muslims refer to the entire 35-acre Temple Mount complex as Al-Aqsa. That complex includes two mosques. Yeah, two. The first is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The second is the Dome of the Rock with its iconic golden roof. That beautiful golden dome, for me and for many others, it's the crowning feature of Jerusalem's skyline. Though, nerd corner alert, the dome hasn't always been gold. It was once covered in tiles and then blackened lead. The Jordanians, shout out to the Jordanians, are responsible for its glow up in 1959, which in Jerusalem terms is basically yesterday. Nuts, no? It's hard to imagine the Jerusalem skyline without that gleaming dome. And I don't know how I feel about that, because the Dome of the Rock was built directly on top of the ruins of the Jewish Holy Temple. Cities on top of cities, holy places on top of holy places, a metaphor for Israel, right? A metaphor for world history. Even though the temples were destroyed, replaced by another religion's house of worship, generations of Jews nonetheless continued to pray at the Western Wall, and they didn't stop until the Jordanians seized control of the Old City during the War of Independence in 1948. The Jordanians barred Jews, not Israelis, Jews, from visiting the Western Wall and other holy sites. They vandalized the ancient graves on Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, and destroyed much of the Old City's Jewish quarter, including almost all of the synagogues, except for the ones they repurposed as stables or chicken coops. For 19 years, the city was divided, split between the Jordanian East and the Jewish West. The seam between the two was a battleground, stray bullets whistling past whenever it got too quiet. Israelis and Jews were denied their right to worship freely or visit the graves of their ancestors. And then came the Six-Day War and the reunification of Jerusalem for Israel. But you'll hear much more about that in our three-part miniseries on the 1967 Six-Day War coming in just a few weeks. For many Israelis, the Jordanian occupation is a cautionary tale, a haunting reminder of what could happen if Israel loses control of Jerusalem again. Because Jerusalem is more than just a city. It's a symbol of what? Depends on who you ask. But that's why it inspires such madness, why it's been used to justify conquest and slaughter. Symbols are powerful. And the older a symbol, the more power it commands. Jerusalem is ancient, and that makes it very, very powerful. Powerful enough to kill for. Powerful enough to die for. Remember our episode on the Hebron riot of 1929? Link in the show notes. Stop me if this sounds familiar. Or pause me, I don't know how you'd stop me. But certain Muslim leaders whipped up their community with a baseless rumor that the Jews were trying to take over or destroy Al-Aqsa. The mob responded by massacring Jews. Lather, rinse, repeat. The oldest trick in the book. It worked in 1929. It worked in 2000 as a pretext to launch the Second Intifada. It worked in 2021. It worked on October 7th, 2023. Al-Aqsa has become a rallying cry, calling Muslims all over the world to defend. And I put that in quotes, this religious site from the Jews. Now, let's be clear, not all Muslims. And let's be clear, Israel took control of the Temple Mount in 1967, but 10 days after the war, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan returned jurisdiction to the Muslim religious authorities in Jordan. And yes, you'll hear more about this in our Six-Day War miniseries. Jews are not allowed to pray on the Temple Mount, though they are allowed to visit. They're not allowed to pray there, that holiest site I was talking about earlier. But of the 7 million Jews in Israel, only 13 to 15,000 visit each year. The ones who do are passionate about their right to worship freely. Because there is something a little weird about the fact that Jews aren't allowed to pray at their holiest site, which is located in Israel, but administered by the religious authorities of a foreign country. A number of lobbying groups have made it their mission to pressure the government into allowing more Jews to visit the site, but they're fairly marginal. Even more marginal are those who advocate for the rebuilding of the Third Temple. They do exist, though. Moshe Dayan didn't cede the jurisdiction of the site to the Waqf because he hated Judaism. He did it because he knew exactly how spicy this issue could get. It was a well-intentioned decision, no matter how you feel about it, so I won't pretend that every Jew is just hunky-dory, that's an American phrase, I think, but hunky-dory, like happy with the status quo. But very, very few are upset enough to do something about it. And that's why, TBH, it grinds my gears to see salacious headlines about Jews storming or attacking the Temple Mount. And I'm not just talking about headlines on Al Jazeera or on your TikTok feed. Even mainstream news sources like CNN use this charged language, which doesn't seem to acknowledge that, one, most Jews aren't storming anything at all. They're just standing there. And two, most Jews have no real interest in visiting the Temple Mount. With due respect to the Temple Mount, if the number of visitors per year is any indication. And still, Hamas has capitalized on the narrative that Jews are plotting to seize Al-Aqsa. There's a reason they named the October 7th attack Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The mosque's name is a shorthand, a symbol of everything that Muslims need to resist. The Al-Aqsa is in danger conspiracy theory has resulted in so much death and hatred over the past century. And it's also created a very ugly desire in the Arab world to erase any Jewish connection to the Temple Mount, to deny the Jewish historical claim to Jerusalem by any means necessary. It wasn't always like this, though. That's why it's so upsetting to me. The Jewish narrative and the Muslim narrative used to be way more compatible. Under the Ottomans, Jews and Muslims didn't worry about who Jerusalem belonged to. Palestinian sources from the time refer to the Temple Mount as the site of King Solomon's temple. And yet today, many Palestinians deny that Jews have any connection to Jerusalem. They've gone so far as to intentionally destroy artifacts from the temple period. Like so much else in this conflict, Jerusalem has become a zero-sum game. The city, and specifically the Temple Mount, is either Jewish or Muslim. Israeli or Arab. Can't be both. Both sides claim Jerusalem as their capital. And the city is divided between its Jewish and Arab residents. 40% Palestinian, 60% Jewish. Can they divide the city in half, with East Jerusalem becoming the Palestinian capital? If so, where exactly will the border be? Can you imagine the Western Wall being in Israel while the Temple Mount is in Palestine? It sounds like a logistical, diplomatic, and military nightmare. And what about the Israeli citizens caught on the quote-unquote wrong side of this new border? I don't have the answers. No one does, and stop pretending like you do if you think you do. Please. The original 1947 partition plan proposed that Jerusalem be an international city administered by UN forces. It's a solution I imagine both sides hate, because in a zero-sum game, there can be no win-win. One side can win or both sides lose, which brings us to our next chapter and the difficult issues dividing Israelis and Palestinians and the barriers to peace. Chapter 2, Borders. Borders are kind of step one to being a country. It's hard to think of any issue that is more zero-sum. I mean, by definition, any piece of land is either in Israel or it's in what would be Palestine. It can't be in both, right? And after 10-7, it's winner take all. That's what it feels like. At the time of this recording, 65% of Israelis think the best solution is one state, Israel. 64% of Palestinians feel exactly the same way, but in reverse. For them, the best solution is, quote, continue to struggle until the liberation of all of historic Palestine. This flavor of one state solution is one way to solve the problem, I guess. It's not all that different from what exists now. Though the state of Palestine was admitted to the UN General Assembly as an observer state in 2012, I don't think many would argue that it's actually a sovereign state. There is Gaza, which until very recently was ruled by Hamas, an internationally recognized terrorist group. And duh, link in the show notes. There's the West Bank, which is largely self-governing, but not exactly autonomous. You know areas A, B, and C. Links in the show notes. We've spoken about this before. This isn't a sustainable status quo. Those are like two little statelets. But what is a sustainable status quo? How can a binational state or a confederation or even a two-state solution work when nearly two-thirds of both Israelis and Palestinians wish the other side would just disappear? So let's pretend for one glorious second that both sides are willing to entertain a solution that doesn't involve one party magically packing up and leaving. What does that even look like? Well, there was the Peel Commission in 1937, which gave the Jews only 17% or so of the land. The Jewish agency reluctantly agreed in principle, but it was kind of moot because the Arabs rejected it. 10 years later, in 1947, the UN had a new idea. The OG Partition Plan, the first two-state solution, aka Resolution 181, which carved up the land into separate Jewish and Arab states, with Jerusalem as a separate entity under international control. But the borders it proposed were, as we said in the 90s, whack. And though the Jews reluctantly accepted them, no one will ever know how those borders would have worked out. Because one day after the Jewish state declared independence, five Arab armies showed up like, oh no you don't, against most bet takers, but at a terrible cost, Israel survived. More than survived. The Jewish state lost 1% of its population in that war, which is tragic, but ended up with way more territory than it had been originally allotted in the partition plan. Instead of controlling 56% of Mandate Palestine, it now held 78%. These new borders were both porous and controversial in that the neighbors didn't acknowledge them as borders at all. The official position of Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria was that these were merely truce lines separating legitimate states from an entity that had no right to exist, which is truly the pettiest way to approach geopolitics. But after Israel's stunning victory in the Six-Day War, and stunning is a descriptive word here, it was stunning no matter how you look at it or who you asked, the Jewish state quadrupled in size. You don't need to listen to our upcoming three-part miniseries to understand that this was wild, though you should because the story is bonkers. After June 67, Israel controlled East Jerusalem, or what some people call the eastern part of Jerusalem, the West Bank, what people call Judea and Samaria, Gaza, the Sinai Peninsula, and the Golan Heights. And its leaders were sure that finally the neighbors would accept peace in exchange for their lost land. But that's not what happened. Yes, Egypt accepted a peace deal in 1979, link in the show notes, once Israel returned the Sinai Peninsula. And Israel did pull out of Gaza in 2005, again, link in the show notes. But the Jewish state still controls the other territories it won in 1967. East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and the West Bank. All are contentious and all raise questions about the borders of a potential Palestinian state. We just talked about how seemingly impossible it will be to divide Jerusalem. That's just one example of the extremely tricky border question. One small part of a giant question mark. But other territories are nearly as contentious. Take the West Bank, aka Judea and Samaria, Yehuda and Shomron, depending on who you're asking. This is the land west of the Jordan River, and if you have to pull out a map to try to understand it, but this is the land west of the Jordan River, originally slated to be part of a proposed Palestinian state. Jordan annexed that territory in 1948. In 67, it came under Israeli control, which raised an important question. What about the 1 million Palestinians who lived there? Unfortunately for everyone, those Palestinians were represented largely by highly militaristic leaders. If there were once peaceful or moderate voices, they were silenced by the extremist factions of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, whose entire reason for existing was to destroy Israel through the so-called armed resistance, like massacring high school kids, hijacking planes. Meanwhile, after 67, Israelis started establishing civilian communities all over the West Bank. Many hugged the Israeli border, but some lay deep in the heart of the West Bank, a defiant message to the world, we're here, we're not going anywhere, we're not going away. And in their eyes, why should they? Let's extend empathy all the way around. The region has a long, rich Jewish history. This was the home of the Judean kingdom, the burial place of so many of the biblical ancestors, the battleground where Bar Kokhba made his doomed last stand against the imperial Romans. It's because of this long history that so many Jews call the region by its biblical name, Judea and Samaria. Whether you know it as the West Bank or as Judea and Samaria, the territory is currently home to roughly 500,000 Jewish Israelis. You've probably heard of the places these people live as settlements. But a settlement sounds rough and unformed, like a like a handful of tents, a trailer, the bones of a town. And most of these communities are officially recognized and permitted by the Israeli government. They have infrastructure, libraries and schools and wineries and municipal pools and universities, buses, mail services. Most of the people in them live wonderfully boring, normal lives in wonderfully boring, normal towns. They're going to be hard to uproot. So what happens to the Jews of the West Bank if there's ever a Palestinian state? What's the plan? Palestinians have no interest in carving these Jewish towns out of their future state, creating a border that looks like a jigsaw puzzle. But Israelis in the West Bank will be up in arms if Israel forcibly uproots them and expels them from their homes. I mean that literally, because as they say in Israel, we've already seen this movie back in 05 when Israel expelled roughly 8,000 Jews, compare 8,000 to 500,000, from their communities in Gaza. Of course, link in the show notes. We all know who took over in Gaza in 2007. We all know what they've been doing for the past 17 years. And after October 7th, we all know what horrors they're willing and able to unleash. I'm referring to the government there. I'm referring to Hamas. Regardless of where they live, most Israelis just aren't willing to give up their homes in exchange for less rather than more security. But let's pretend for a moment that Israelis aren't traumatized and scarred by the uprooting of Jewish communities in Gaza and the subsequent Hamas takeover. Could Israeli towns in the West Bank simply remain under Palestinian rule in a future Palestinian state? Would the Palestinians be okay with that? Would Israelis? Hold that thought. We're going to come back to it. And what about all of the Jewish historical and holy sites across the West Bank? Would Jews still be allowed to visit their sacred places? What about the West Bank city of Hebron, which is deeply sacred to Jews? Low-key, the three posters in my childhood Baltimore bedroom were of Hebron, Michael Jordan, and Tupac. You might remember from our episode on the Hebron riots that the city was home to a small Jewish community for centuries until their neighbors turned on them in 1929. For decades, Hebron was free of Jews, but after the Six-Day War, Jews returned to their ancient city once again. This time, they have no intention of leaving. The tiny Jewish community of Hebron is ultra-nationalist. Many are driven by the sentiments of Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Cook, who in May of 67 criticized the Israeli government. Think of that month, May. May of 67, he criticized them for giving up any part of the Holy Land. Or as he put it, have we the right to give up even one grain of the land of God? Religious hardliners on both sides truly believe that it's a sin to give up even an inch of this sacred land. So what happens to the deeply religious Jews in places like Hebron? Will they be allowed to stay put in their homes, regardless of who is in charge? Would they remain citizens of Israel or of Palestine? And if they even are accepted as citizens of Palestine, how will they be treated? How should they think they will be treated? The current situation in Hebron isn't exactly the greatest model for coexistence. Israel keeps very strict control of the city's mostly Palestinian population in order to protect the Jewish minority. Hebron's Palestinians say they're treated like second-class citizens at best, at prisoners at worst. And that's just the West Bank. There are plenty of other disputed areas in and around Israel. Take the northern border, home to the Golan Heights. Before the Six-Day War in 67, seriously guys, I'm so excited for you to listen to the upcoming series. It's like all I'm thinking about. The Syrians spent their time shelling the Israeli villages below. For obvious reasons, the Jewish state isn't keen to give up the Golan anytime soon. Especially not to Syria's current dictator. But other than Israel itself, as of this recording in March of 2024, the U.S. is the only country to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. What happens to the Golan Heights if there's ever a Palestinian state? And then, of course, there's the practical issue that Palestinians are divided between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which aren't even connected to each other. How the heck is that supposed to work? Do we build a bridge? Dig a tunnel? Too soon. It's a thorny issue, and part of its thorniness comes from the problem Israel is most obsessed with, for obvious reasons, and that is security. Tune in next week, where we will unpack the last two seemingly difficult issues we'll have to solve for peace. I'll say, as always, if you have thoughts, comments, ruminations, whatever to share, do not hesitate. Contact me at noam@jewishunpacked.com. Unpacking Israeli History is a production of Unpacked, a division of Open Door Media. Check out jewishunpacked.com for everything Unpacked related. And one more time, write to me at noam@jewishunpacked.com. This episode was produced by Rivki Stern. Our team for this episode includes Jason Kessler, Adi Elbaz, and Rob Pera. I'm your host, Noam Weissman. Thanks for listening. See you next week.